Well, good morning. Sorry for the last minute. Mostly sorry to the media team for the last minute side there. But we're covering a fair amount of ground today vis-a-vis what a schedule would look like. I think because maybe it's the case that y'all have more questions about kind of the three main topics that we're talking about today. I'm not terribly intellectually curious about two of the topics. I think they seem kind of obviously non-players to me, but if anybody, I could very well be wrong. I haven't thought on it a whole bunch. So if anybody wants to delve into this, we want to go longer on those topics. We can certainly expand into the next 2 or 3 weeks with no problem. If anything, this would be schedule compression, not extending it. So please feel free to say, hey, I want to talk about this topic. I want to talk about it a lot. We're very much open to that. So today, what we want to talk a little bit more about are three traits, properties of God's that should inform our thinking on him. And like I kind of highlighted last time, will also can significantly inform when we talk about the doctrines that are really the places where Christianity, various forms of Christianity differ. So where Catholicism and Protestantism differ often is not on the properties that God has. There's not the doctors of the church, or the Catholic Church, and some of the theologians and philosophers in the Protestant Church don't sit there and have such major disagreements on the nature of God that it's a huge debate that reaches the laity. I will say that the stuff that we typically care about are things like, what about the theological points that are derived from our doctrine of Scripture, that are derived from our belief of who God is, that type of thing. So whether it's kind of the one that we hear about a lot here, which is like, what's the nature of man? What is original sin do to you? What is the Eucharist, a real thing, an actual thing, a symbolic thing? How do they work? They will be informed by this kind of stuff, but interestingly, a lot of the disagreement isn't about who God is and how God is. Mostly because of this. If God is sitting here, we'll try to simplify him a little bit, although we'll talk about divine simplicity, and let's pretend that he has, some number of major properties that are really the ones that actually matter. These are the properties that matter. So how many lines that up here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. These are 9, for argument's sake here, 10 properties of God's. People, I think, will think through these properties and say, okay, this one I know, I believe, this one I believe this one, I believe this one. This one's really important to me, and this one's really important to me. And this set of properties of God's, they'll say, I don't really know. It's not something that leapt out at me from Scripture. I haven't really thought about that much. I'm okay. I'm open with it being any of these. The problem is when you go from this kind of doctrine of God stuff down to, here's a doctrine of the cross. Here's a doctrine of, we'll call this salvation as well. Here's a doctrine of man. Here's a good one. Doctrine of the Holy Spirit. Is the Holy Spirit still active today in the same way he was earlier on? All these kinds of things. These actually are informed very much by these properties. And if you have very solid properties, let's pretend that these are the properties of God, they would deal most with the doctrine of salvation. God's all just, but he's also all loving. Let's say that those were two of these things. Here he is just, here he is loving. And so as a result, you kind of put a couple of those together and you say, well, maybe I understand now why Christ had to die. You see? So those two things will inform that one. It's these unknowns that inform a lot of the things, like I'll give you an example of sovereignty. Sovereignty is a debate point that's been it's as old as Christianity is. A lot of these ones that people don't think about, that people don't think about, are the ones that have key implications for things like the doctrine of divine sovereignty. So one of the reasons I think it's good to talk about this stuff that may feel kind of dry and boring, I'll admit, if you're not really into doing this kind of philosophy or theology, you're kind of like, let's get to the practical application. Where's the part that matters when it comes to Christian doctrine? The more you know about that, the more certain you are of what those properties are, the more certain you are of your doctrine. And a lot of these doctrinal differences arise because people will believe these and say, maybe I don't need to think about these right here. But the people who think about all of them say, well, your view doesn't work because it doesn't all fit together. So this project of doing all of this together is the project of systematic theology. And I would just repeat again to you, in my opinion, no theology that isn't systemically consistent is true. It might be part true, it might be 50% true, it might be 90% true, but the problem with a 90-10 mix, like a 90-10 mix of a lie, is that 90-10 mix can really set you off in the wrong direction. It doesn't mean that you're headed 90% in the wrong direction. If your 10% really steers you off course, that can be significant. Okay, so that was enough pontificating. Let's talk about some of these divine properties. We'll talk about the ones that I think are a little more easy to, or I want to be spend less time on natively, but open to y'all. These are properties that have arisen, to my understanding, mostly in the medieval period, where the medieval period here, I know in popular culture, we talk about the medieval period in a derogatory manner. Hey, that's medieval level thinking. That's stupid. We've gotten smarter than that. That's not the case in Christian theology. A lot of absolutely phenomenal thinking was done in the Middle Ages by some very clever folks. So the stuff I'm going to talk about, at least in my mind, comes under the guise of classical theism. Classical theism, which is, this is kind of, for a long time, the way that we've thought about God. So we know the kind of the big omnis, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent. So those are kind of the major theistic properties that I think everybody agrees on. We're going to talk about omnipresence today in some more detail, and I think interesting detail. But past that, there are some other properties that are ascribed to God. One of them, and I'll use it, I think, as the shortest one to kind of dismiss, is the doctrine that God is impassible. And impassible is just a weird and archaic way of saying he doesn't feel emotions. So the general thrust here is something like, hey, we all agree, if we're cool and rational and reasonable, that's us thinking like we ought to think. But when we get emotions into it, that's when we start thinking wrong things. Or I'm thinking of the scene from The Matrix with the architect, where the architect says, I see in your brains the beginning of a chemical process that signals the onset of an emotion, which is specifically there to overturn reason or something along that line. So emotion is considered anti-reason in some ways or in some senses. So God would not be like that, is the idea. And so because God wouldn't feel any emotion at all, that would be, if God doesn't feel any emotion at all, that would be divine impassibility. Okay. There's two sides to that, obviously, as at least two. One side might be something like this. Well, what we mean by that is that God, who exists timelessly, now you'll see we're already back to time. This is part that's going to inform it. If God exists timelessly, then he's not changing in how he feels. So he feels everything all at once, so to speak. It's all there, whatever that feeling, whatever that emotion is, if there was such a thing, it would be all at the same time. That's one thing to think of. The other one, because the biblical data, we all know, seems to say something different, doesn't it? It seems like God regretted ever having made mankind on the earth and blah, 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 blah. Or here, Jesus, if you're going to jump forward into doctrine, Jesus wept at Lazarus's death, even knowing that he can bring him back from the dead. Here he is identifying with mankind in such a degree that he's weeping. Okay, so some of a lot of the biblical data seem to suggest that God does feel stuff, that he is kind of there with us, that his feelings change, that he feels love for us, and maybe some people would say prior to salvation, God hates the sinner, but then when he becomes a child, then he loves him. You know, that there are people who argue that way. So there's a lot of different ways to look at this, but the major question boils down to, does God actually feel? Does he emote? Does he change in that emotion? That's maybe a secondary point to the first one. So the people who believe in divine impassibility say, no, God doesn't feel any emotion. People who do believe in divine impassibility basically turn around and be like, have you read the Bible? The Bible seems to suggest that. That's the reason I believe it. So I leave that to your, well, one, any comment on that? Does anybody have any opinion, any thoughts on it? Yes, sir.
it doesn't seem to be biblical. Is this like Greek, or is this like something that, like as you mentioned, may have come out of the Middle Ages?
I'm certainly not an expert. You guys know I'm not an expert on anything that I'm talking about in this class. I'm even less of an expert on where you can trace doctrinal views back to. But my understanding is that people have been dealing with the concept of how does God relate to man since prior to Christian times. In Jewish times, the question is, what is the right picture of God? Is God like a loving father that holds us as a baby? Is God a distant and a powerful being? So even in considering pre-Christian Jewish biblical data, you have to deal with the concept of does Yahweh feel for us? And the Jewish idea, at least from the kind of rabbinical stuff that I know this much about, seems to suggest that God does do that. So I think it's more the Christian trying to take, as you pointed out, Greek thought and Jewish thought, and then their own biblical data, and say, what's the systematic view that makes the most sense out of it? But if you want specific names of guys that wrote extensively on the subject, I'm a poor resource for you. Okay. Other stuff on divine impassibility. All right, so I don't think it's unimportant. I think it is important. But I would just, I almost want to say that there are so much biblical data that use language of God feeling for us and loving us, that to say that God doesn't feel anything emotionally just seems hard to me to support with biblical data. So that's kind of where I come off on that position. I don't know. I'm not going to sit here and make several arguments for that, because I just feel that it's both intuitive and that it's also sufficiently biblically evidenced. I don't think that there ought to be too much debate about it. But awful lot of terribly smart doctors of the church that disagree with that.
It seems to me that it's like the opposite of anthropomorphic. It's almost like, hey, if you have emotion, because human beings fail in emotion, then God has to fail in emotion too.
Yeah, right. And that's a great point. In fact, if you kind of think on what he's talking about there, and you say, well, we might cycle through something. We feel angered if our spouse or friend or son or daughter or parent does something wrong, but then we also later, then we kind of like, well, you know, when I put it in proper context, and then I can easily forgive. Just because we do this cycle stuff doesn't mean God hasn't hit all of those. He's both grieved and he loves. Almost think of the pinnacle of grief that you would have if your son or daughter did something wrong, but the amount of love that you have for him, that he can do both at the same time at the maximal levels of each one of them, maybe something like that. So I think that's a good way to say God, I think even timelessly, could probably do that. I think that's reasonable to say. And because that's possible, I want to say that if it's a possible thing that God can do, and it would make him maximally great to have that property, from a perfect being theology perspective, I almost want to grant it for just that reason. Al?
Yeah, I think it might be the result of our secular culture. The idea is that truth is ultimately impersonal, and from a Christian perspective, truth is ultimately personal. And so, you wouldn't have this emotions versus reason idea if you really have a biblical understanding.
So when you say truth is personal, what do you mean by that?
Well, ultimately truth comes from God, so, and God is a personal being. So.
Okay, right. Yeah, and I think in that sense, absolutely, the Christian's committed to that view. Any theist is committed to that view, I think. So if I were going to try to argue against that one, I would do two. One, I would say this is the fault of language, right? Anytime we use the word personal, we can mean 10 different things by that. So one, he means sourced in a person, or that it has an objective grounding in a particular person. That's the person of God. Another way of personal could be subjective. My personal experience is different from your personal experience, in which case, that is the case. You may perceive truth from your subjective point of view, but you may perceive objective truth that both you and God perceive. So in that sense, truth can be objective, in that there's an object that is a reference of your thought, but your subjective perception of that thought, of that object, may be twisted, whereas maybe we could say God's is always perfect. So there's a lot, I mean, you can go, this is one of those philosophical points that you could drill down on for days, but I'll just pause to note that, yeah, I think the Christian is committed to seeing God as a personal source of all reality, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't something that is objectively real that is not God. That is to say, is it possible that God, personally, created an object that is not God, and that object is real? If so, you can have that's a non-personal objective reality. So in that sense, then maybe that somebody could quibble with that definition. But yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. All right. Divine impassivity, something to think about. I just find it noteworthy in that you have to think about it when you're doing systematic theology, but I just find I don't see the threat from divine impassibility that says God cannot both be unchanging and also have emotion. I think he can eternally emote these things. Now, we can talk about how that happens in time. We talked about time, and we will need to talk about that later. But you'll see that we're going to reference both what time really is and who God really is, both kind of outside of time or atemporally or statically or however you want to put it, and then also in this world traveling along with us in what we perceive as time too. Okay, divine impassibility, one thing. A second one, divine simplicity. I don't know if there are a lot of philosophers and theologians that still hold this view that God is simple, so simple that he has, well, that's not true. The idea of divine simplicity is that God is not composed of parts, that God is the simplest possible being. So the part where that's going to get contentious is when philosophers start saying something that I don't like, but it's kind of a necessity because of language, is, well, in this sense, God is divinely simple. But in this sense, you know, maybe there's an exception to it. So I will probably just almost kind of skip over divine simplicity just by saying the concept of divine simplicity is something that's going to come into play when we talk about the Trinity, where the Trinity is are these parts of God that are independent? Are they not parts of God? Are they somehow three consciousnesses that are also, or persons or whatever, that don't compose parts of God, that they are part of the whole, that they are the whole? This is part of where Trinitarian theory in reality is going to encounter some difficulties, at least against the Unitarian. The Unitarian gets to shrug and be like, I don't have any problem if divine simplicity turns out to be true because I only got to worry about one person. Whereas the Trinitarian has to say, if divine simplicity is true, I got to have a way to explain the Trinity that isn't a God that has gods for parts or isn't a God that has persons for parts. So that's something just to keep in mind that's going to be part of the debate. I don't want to get into it too much because it is very deeply philosophical, and you have to reference a whole bunch of philosophy that is quite painful in following it. Stuff like, there are terms called Mariology out there, like, is this world actually made up of different things, or is it really all one thing? And I don't mean like the Buddhist sense, but like, is this just fluctuations in a quantum vacuum of some sort? These are different energy levels that compose all the parts, or are the parts important? Is it meaningful to say Al was not in existence prior to whatever Al's birthday was or conception date was, and then Al is in existence, and then when Al dies, he goes out of existence? Do things come into and go out of existence? And if they're souls or spirits, are they permanent? You know, all that stuff. So there's a lot of philosophy behind it. I just paused to note that's one of these tick marks up here that we don't think about a lot but are going to have some implications. So I would just encourage you to think about it a little bit on your own when you have some time, or if you want to do any reading on it, that'll be something that is important. Okay, maybe the next one, we'll spend some time on, there's a couple more that we can hit eventually, but the one that I would like to spend the most time on, because I think it has the most implications for the stuff that we're going to talk about, and in the long run, it has the most implication doctrinally downstream. And secondly, interestingly, it's a very underrepresented topic in philosophy, Christian philosophy and theology. People have not written much on this. People have not appeared to put a ton of thought towards this. And that's the concept of omnipresence, What does it mean for God to be present elsewhere? Also, I know we've got a question I mean to address that you wrote. Did you write in a question about... did you send a YouTube video to me the other day?
Oh, it was on this minute physics thing.
Yeah, so I'm going to hit that. Don't let me... When we get close to top of the hour, let me know because I want to stop and answer that question. It's an interesting question. Omnipresence. What does it mean? What do you think it means? God is omnipresent. God is everywhere. While you're... Somebody... Give me an idea of what you mean, and I'm going to look up...
Is that a question?
It is a question. What do you think omnipresence is? What do we mean when we say God is everywhere?
Raising my hand.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I'll start. May I?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Go back to that point in time. Bang. It's all here. Everything. Everything that you ever thought, felt, saw, would see, every person, every conceivable combination of anything man and beyond can imagine occurred in at that time, at once, at one bang. Call it a big bang if you want to call it whatever term.
Okay.
That to me encompasses omnipresence.
That's ubiquitous.
Okay. Okay. Let's pretend that we don't have a Harvard vocabulary. Break out ubiquitous for us.
Everywhere,
all the time. Okay, so whether that time is all compressed down to kind of a single moment or whether it runs out over some line, that God is in all of those places. But what does it mean to be in all those places? Like, and here's some of the scriptural data that support it. This is David in Psalm 139. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day and the darkness is as light with you. So I think some people will say that God is everywhere. Now, there are interesting questions that you can immediately ask that I'll just raise for you, but then we won't answer them. That means God's everywhere on earth. Does that mean God's in hell? If there's a hell, is where? Okay, so yes. That would be probably the doctrine of omnipresence says that God is everywhere. What else does God... What is God doing in these everywheres?
I think to go back to your, what do you call it, divine simplicity.
Yeah.
It also says that God is formless.
Formless,
and
okay, yeah.
He, you know, has this ability to permeate. If you say presence as opposed to... omniscience, as opposed to knowing. Like, I know what's going on everywhere is different than I am everywhere.
Okay, so he's jumping straight to a point that I think is very, very interesting and important. So let's highlight some of what Skyler is talking about here. If you go back to classical theism and you ask the question, what does it mean to be omnipresent? People will say, like here, if we go back to this as an example and say, what does this imply? One, notice that this says, where shall I go from your spirit? So what Skyler's saying is by God being formless, that also kind of implies he's not material. He's not made up of matter and energy. Because the whole universe, if it's finite, has a shape. And that doesn't mean that God is universe-shaped. That God is not contained. He's not exhausted by the size and shape of the universe. That somehow he transcends it, or that the universe is not all of God that there would be kind of idea. And here, the author is talking about God is in all of these places. Now, does that mean he knows what's going on in all these places? Or does that mean that he is somehow physically in all of these places? That's really maybe one of the questions that we want to answer. And I would point out that as we think about that, if omniscience is being... and this is going to get back to the point that I just kind of skipped over. Omniscience is knowing everything. So here's the set of all things that God knows. It's a set of all things, and God knows all those things. If our universe is some small subset of this one, then if God is omnipresent, we'll just call it O-M-N-P for simplicity's sake, shortness, brevity's sake. If God is omnipresent, just meaning that he knows what's going on in the universe, and that's really just a subset of omniscience, isn't it? If he's not in the universe in any spatial way, in any physical way, or something like that, then tell me what the difference is between God knowing what's going on in the universe and God being present in the universe. If what we mean by being present is simply that he knows what's going on there at that time. Seems to me that that's the same thing. That's the exact same thing. In fact, when you write them out physically, they say the same things. Carl's making the face that says, not quite, but...
I'm trying to get my brain wrapped around what you're saying right now.
Okay. Well, feel free to jump in.
Okay.
If there's something different than that, so I want to say maybe there's something different, and I will jump ahead to it since Skylar jumped ahead to it too, and maybe we can get to discussion faster, which is good. Randy.
The idea of omnipresence mentioned, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, outside of Psalms or songwriting.
Yeah, great question. The answer is yes. Let me see if I can pull. I will find a set of scriptures and say it to you. But the answer is yes. And by the way, great point. If your point is only found in psalm lyrics, where we know the author uses hyperbole, where we know the author uses flowery language that isn't meant to be taken as a scientific statement, then one has to be careful. I'm with you on that one. And so for that reason, I would not want to extract from something like Psalm 139. Well, he says...
When they talk about omnipresence or
right.
So.
Well, so to break out Randy's point even a little bit more is something like this. We say things like, well, do we believe that God is here in this room with us? You know, the correct Christian answer there is, yes, absolutely, he's in this room with us today. Is he in, or is God in heaven? A lot of people, if you ask them, will say, where is God right now? Or where is Jesus? Well, he's in heaven. Where is heaven? Well, now it's this physical place, usually cloud-based, with a throne on it, and God sitting on this throne. Are these anthropomorphic articulations actual? Is God physically located in heaven and then not here? Well, that would not be the divine, that would not be to say that God is omnipresent. To say that God is omnipresent is to say that he is both in heaven, if there is a physical place called heaven, and he is in this physical universe. Now, if the physical place that we call heaven simply means, or differently means, a spiritual realm, a non-physical realm, then he's also omnipresent in that non-physical realm too. But the idea of omnipresence is anywhere that there is, God also is. And that would include, as has been pointed out, even hell, if hell is a physical place too.
You asked what is God doing if he's everywhere? And something that I forget what verse it is, but it says something like, in him we live and move and have our being.
Yes.
So I've always thought that in some way he is everywhere and he's also kind of holding everything together.
And that's an interesting, so let's break out three things from what he said there. One, he's quoting Paul, quoting Greek philosophers who are talking about God moving, that we are in God, do we have our being? So he's calling out from their own religion to say, this is something that you guys have in your own worldview. So, I have forgotten the verse now. I do need to look it up. If anybody's got, Carl, do you mind looking up where sustaining is, Sagan?
It's Acts that it's calling in the Baptist.
Yeah, but where there's a verse that talks about God sustaining the world. So one of the things that theology says about God is that he is causal, or the doctrine of the doctrine of God also contains the idea that God frequently does that God is sustaining this world in existence. You'll hear some Christian theologians say it this way: if God were to stop thinking about us, we would all cease to exist. So that God sustains the world moment by moment somehow, and that it is his power that keeps this even in existence at all. Maybe kind of from the idea of God calls all this stuff into existence from nothing. If he ceases that call, then it might just return back to nothing. I don't know that that's the case. I think it's possible that God could call something forward and say, and I also want it to have its own existence, and so it stays in existence unless I specifically go back and destroy it. But there are biblical data, and hopefully someone can find it, that suggests that God is in fact sustaining the existence of the world as well. And so I think that's a key point. And then maybe the third part that I would break out, which was also a reference back to what Skylar said, is in the doctrine of, one of the ideas of the doctrine of divine simplicity is this difference that I put between omniscience, that's knowing everything, and omnipresence, that's basically knowing everything going on in this universe, that the reason that those are very similar is some people who believe in divine simplicity and particular versions of it would also say, that's right, all of God's properties are in fact just human ways of talking about all these different things, that in fact God is so simple that he only has one property, that is the property of being God, and all these things that we break out are just human ways of conceiving of the aggregation of all this. That's like, instead of looking at the car's a terrible example because it's got a bunch of parts to it, but that it is in the property of being a car that things that you have, that one has wheels and engines and all that other kind of stuff. And so these parts aren't, it's not like you could take this part out and leave it out or add this one to it. That to be a perfect car is to have all these things. We just call them sub things so that we understand how the whole system works. That's a terrible analogy because there seem to be really parts to cars. But the idea of God is all these traits really just reduced to the trait of divinity. Now, that doesn't get a lot of play in philosophy because philosophy reduces from a library down to a single book if you do things that way.
So to your verse about the sustaining in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1, long ago God spoke to our ancestors in many and various ways by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also created the worlds. He is the reflection of God's glory and the exact imprint of God's very being, and he sustains all things by his powerful word.
Yes, exactly. So this is a great biblical data point that should inform Christian theology if, by the doctrine of Revelation, one has come to believe that the book of Hebrews is canon. So you see the logic chain that I'm running through there. It sounds like I'm quibbling, but I just want you to see that everything that we're talking about traces through stuff that we are talking about. It is a systematic view. But that is a thank you, Carl.
So if we're all sitting around one day and we decide, okay, we're going to take all religious belief, we're just going to put it in a box for a while, or put it away from our minds.
Okay.
What we think of, and the only possible thing that any human can imagine, collectively, singularly, will never reach the meaning and definition of God.
Okay. Now, this to me sounds like it, we're talking about knowability, what we can know about God, and maybe... Okay, what else?
Well, there's a whole vehicle there, if you want to say that. But the fact is that there is no vehicle. Okay? Right? The idea that if God created in his mind...
Yeah.
Wrong. Come on. Wrong. We have a mind. We do.
Okay.
Does God have a mind? No one knows that. But if you put everything aside once again and start thinking about it, at least the conclusion that I've come up with.
Yeah.
You know, God is certainly... out there somewhere, certainly not physical, something just beyond any human's capacity to understand.
So that is a real possibility, and if by understand you mean know every true, something like this, knowing every true proposition about God. Can one human being know every true proposition about God? Probably not. Well, can one human being, quote unquote, wrap their mind around God? You know, to use less precise language.
There is no language. There is nothing a human can speak or think that fathoms the depth of God. Nothing. There isn't anything.
Okay, and if what?
And I'm not talking about eschatology or anything like that. There just is simply nothing in the world that we live in that compares to what God is.
Okay. Yeah, when you come to analogous knowledge of God, this is a light bulb. It's like the sun, just a smaller version, and it operates on some different principles. Yes, if you're going to talk about
Greek, we can look at it. Yeah, Hebrew, Greek, any language you want. There is no language to explain. There is no way to put it into words.
Okay, then let's say that's the case. Now we can get. I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole because there's a whole bunch of philosophy that deals with whether language is even real. If it may be the case, though, that let's say that in your mind you have thoughts. Let's say that you guys, that you think something about love. You want to try to tell somebody how much you love, fill in the blank, your mom, your dad, your son, your spouse, whatever. You might say this, it's too much for words. I could not, even if I started talking now, and I tried and I had my whole life to tell you how much I love this person, it still wouldn't be good enough for me to communicate to you how I feel. So it may be the case that you can never put into language things that you sense yourself. So if you want to say that's true, then the next question that is kind of entailed by that is, well, is it possible to conceive of it? Because you conceive of how much you love your spouse. You feel that you know that. You'd say, I know how much I love my spouse. Is it possible to know everything about God? It seems to me the case that no, there's at least one thing that you wouldn't know about God, which is an easy one, which is what does it feel like to be God? Even if God were to tell you everything about you, he sat you down and says, we're going to take forever. I'm going to tell you every true fact about me, and I'm going to give you perfect memory so you can memorize it all. And he transmits to you every bit of knowledge that he has. The one thing he can't transmit to you is what does it feel like to be God? So in that sense, maybe theoretically you could say there's at least one fact about God that we can't know. And maybe more practically, since nobody's got that level of memory or cognitive capacity, et cetera, then we can say, well, it's trivially easy to say we're not going to get God completely. But I don't think that destroy, to take that to its extreme would be to destroy the project of theology at all in total, which is to say, well, since we can't know anything about God, since we can't know God entirely, then don't bother learning anything about God because you're never going to get it right. Well, I know that's not what you're arguing, but I don't think that's a good conclusion either, because for the very simple fact that God seems to tell us things about himself. And so if God is telling us things about himself, and it's not the case, or it's false, that you can understand things about God in such a way that you know truth, then God is actively deceiving you. And if God's actively deceiving you, then that same God that you say is all perfect and omnibenevolent and all that stuff, now you've got a conflict. And you have a logical contradiction that prevents your concept of God from being real. So I think that we can throw it, I'm tempted to throw out that conclusion of don't bother knowing anything about God at all for the simple reason that God seems to be telling us stuff about himself. Now maybe you could stop short. That's right.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if this is a useful point, but the way that I've always thought about God's omnipresence is, kind of like my hand is basically has infinite two-dimensional planes in it. If God is a higher dimensional being,
yes,
then he can, that would kind of explain how he could be in time and out of time. But I know that you said that you don't believe that higher dimensions exist.
Yeah, it is the case that I don't believe higher dimensions exist, but let's think about it in two, who cares what I think? Let's say higher dimensions do exist. Is it the case that God's a higher dimensional being? If what you mean by that is God is present in that higher dimension, then the doctrine of omnipresence would tell you that has to be the case. But it also means that he doesn't just, if there is a fourth dimension, if there is a fifth dimension, if there's a 20th dimension, God, by omnipresence, would have to be present in all of those dimensions. It is the case, forgetting the mathematical reasons, my objections to higher dimensions are on the basis of the mathematics that justify our belief that higher dimensions exist, and then as one side, and then the separate side is, in my opinion, of what it is that mathematics actually represents about the real world. So there's two ways to go to it. On the one case, the use of complex numbers to express these fields to me implies that they're, in fact, imaginary, just like the complex number uses as a term. I know mathematicians will object to that characterization, but the other part though is what is it? I think all math has to have a referent, or it doesn't. It isn't valid. So saying 1 + 1 = 2 doesn't, it, to me, is an abbreviation. You're actually saying 1 iPad + 1 iPad = 2 iPads, because if you don't give it a referent, it's not true. 1 iPad + 1 iPhone does not equal 2 iPad iPhones. You have to place a reference, or maybe more specifically, 1 iPad + 1 iPhone doesn't equal 2 oranges. The units matter, and so I think that all mathematics is a truncation of a full statement. I think the same is true of logic.
Apply it into symbolic logic too, Scott.
Absolutely.
That statements of pure logic, which don't have a referent, are not true.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take.
That's the logical consequence.
Yeah, I'm going to have. I will take a 2-minute diversion into this one, even though I know not everybody's going to want to talk about this one. So if you don't tune out for a second, if you don't want to hear this, but yes, I object to characterizations of de dicto and de re. I object to the idea of logically possible and strictly logically possible, or strictly logically true and logically true. So it's the case that you, here's an example that I think, if I understand it properly, broadly logically possible versus strictly logically possible. Philosophers differ, logicians differ, say these are two different things. I disagree. They'll say something like this. This man is married and he is unmarried. That is strictly logically impossible. That's strictly logically contradictory, because you can't be both married and unmarried in the same way at the same time. It violates the law of non-contradiction. So we can read that sentence and say this sentence is false. If you express it this way, though, this bachelor is married, that is not strictly logically false. That's not strictly logically contradictory. It's broadly logically impossible. It's broadly logically contradictory, but it's not strictly so. Now, to me, all that you're saying is, I used a shorthand for saying this unmarried man is married. But if you actually wrote the definitions of the words out, if you didn't abbreviate, if you said, and a bachelor is an unmarried man, so you pull out the word bachelor and you stick unmarried man in here, now you get this unmarried man is married. That's obviously strictly logically contradictory. So this is, in my opinion, maybe back to what Sean, some of the things he was referencing, that God was, in the same things he was saying about God, when you don't abbreviate, if you actually wrote out everything that you meant, there is only strictly logically possible and impossible. That anything else is an artifact of trying to use shorthand. And I think mathematics, when it fails, when it succeeds because it correctly applies, even in the shorthand, the full statement. And when it fails, or when we get confused about it, it's because we haven't bothered to consider these other things. So
it brings a raw concept into a physical manifestation. In other words, it brings it into something, a picture, if you want to call it. You can see a result.
And that's the goal of all languages, to kind of see what you're talking about.
I think you're running, and again, I know this is, I'll just make a comment, and you and I can have lunch and discuss.
Yeah, right.
But I think if
everything has to have
a referent, then you may not be able to do deductive logic. You may only be able to do inductive logic, right? So you may not be able to get to the law of modus ponens or modus tollens or the law of non-contradiction if you require a referent.
And what I want to say is, can you use those laws in such a way where you do have a referent? And so I'll give you an example of how it goes wrong. If you're going to say those are tools, but they have limits, okay, that's good. What we'll say is, this is a general tool, but it has limits at here and here. But here's one that they always give first-year philosophy students. You've probably seen this before. What am I going to write here? This statement is false. And then you can argue all day long, well, if it's false, then the statement's true, which contradicts the statement itself. Or if the statement is true, then it's telling you it's false, in which case the statement would be false, but it told you something true about that. So this seems like a contradiction. The reason that this doesn't work, the reason that this causes a problem, a paradox, is because it's a broken use of what's supposed to be going on here. This statement right here is supposed to be referring to the whole. This statement is the antecedent, and the referent is that it contains itself in the referent. So I object to that. I don't think that that's okay to do. And because I don't think it's okay to do, I'm not concerned with this one, because what I'm saying is, fill in the blank with what is this statement. What is this statement that you put in there? When it comes to bachelor, I can drop a definition in there. Drop in a definition of this statement to me. And the reason that, and if you say, I can't, it's the whole, then I'll say, then you're trying to say this part is the whole. Or this part has a characteristic that is also characteristic of the whole, identically so. Or something like that. That would take a lot more justification to make that last statement that I said. But this is an example of what happens when logic breaks. And I think complex numbers are an example. I don't think complex numbers are bad. I actually think that we are totally on to something when it comes to complex numbers. But I think it is, and I don't think it's another dimension, but I think in going to it very quickly and not breaking this out, I think it refers to the density of space, time, matter, energy, whatever you think those can. I think we're talking about a density against a theoretical field that we have. because we like to measure things length, width, by height. But that it's basically a reflection of reality, of density. But anyway, that's a long right turn. Let's have lunch and discuss it in great detail. It's very interesting to me. But back on omnipresence, you brought something up that is really where I want to go, and Skylar had started on this direction as well. Let's consider ourselves. Your mind, where is your mind? Or your spirit, where is your spirit? What do you think? Where is your mind or spirit? Left field. That's probably metaphorically true frequently. Where is it in reality, physically? Okay, one view is to say it's an illusion.
It's not an illusion. It's just it doesn't
exist in space.
It doesn't exist in independent of our physical existence.
Okay. It doesn't exist independent of our... Okay, so this is a physicalist version, an epiphenomenal version. Yes, okay. For the sake of argument, though, let's put epiphenomenalism off to the side. Let's put pure physicalism off to the side. And let's answer the question as what I think most people are intuitively. You might not be. I think I know that you are not. Dualists. What if you're a substance dualist or a variation of a substance dualist that says there's really a body... There's really a soul or spirit. Those are both real things, and you can yank contra what he's saying. You can pull the soul out of the body, and they're still two different real things.
This body is yearning and aching to have the new body, and so there's some evidence to that idea.
Okay, so let's just assume, whether scripturally justified or we just want to talk about it as dualists, that it is the case that the spirit is a different thing than the body. Where is the spirit in this physical world? Or let me ask the question differently. Is your spirit in this room right now? And if so, can you tell me specifically where your spirit is in this room?
Randy.
It's in some spiritual dimension that interacts with the physical body in a way that, no, it's not in, you can't confine it to any three-dimensional space in this room, but it still has... some connection, for lack of a better term, to space, to the space I'm occupying.
Right? What do you think about this statement or this idea?
You done?
Yeah. Well, let's follow up. We'll come back to what you're going to say. Let's follow up on this one. What do you think about this? Does that sound right to you?
It sure seems right to me. Yeah.
Okay.
I have to admit, I personally buy into a multidimensional universe, not in the multiverse sense,
right. but that there might be
God
higher
God is a higher dimensional being, etc. And I think that analogy works well for me just at an intuitive level.
Okay.
And somehow our spirit is interacting through our body. I think our spirit or soul, depending on if you want to make a distinction there, is the driver of our decision making.
Okay.
And acts through this physical body, but I don't think my spirit is residing in my brain right now.
Okay, then let's use Randy's terminology. You agree, maybe I agree. Randy has said it this way: the spirit isn't like physically in this world, but it's connected to stuff in here. Where is to what points is your spirit connected? That's my next question.
I think
Yeah, right.
That's my main.
That's his argument.
I love it.
That's actually how it works.
QED, right? So, in that sense, you know, here's the guy. I'm terrible at cartoons, so you're gonna get a stick man instead of cartoons. This guy is standing there with an eating disorder, and he's angry about it. And so here's his ghost, and his ghost is kind of wavy.
Yeah.
And has is better fed. The shape of his ghost includes his head, his body, his arms, his legs. Is that true? Is your spirit connected to your left toe? When you trim your toenails, do you lose a little bit of your spiritual connection? Does your spiritual connection go off with your toenails somewhere else, just to be particularly gross about it? Are you slowly spreading over places and leaving bits of your spirit all over the place? Where's your spirit connected?
It has to be connected to your mind. That is like your brain.
Okay, so we want to, he says, all right, don't be silly. It's not connected to your left toenail. It's connected to your brain.
If you cut off certain sections of my brain, I appear to stop being able to do certain things like feel happiness or emotion, things that are generally associated, mental properties that are associated with the soul.
All right, so yes, sir.
So when you say that
So when Jesus died and came back, he had a different body, I think. He had a body that was able to appear in a room, but it was also able to eat. It also had holes in his hands and in his side. You know, but it was different, and I don't know that we can definitely say, you know, where it's connected to. It was Jesus, but you know, it could also pass through walls or appear in spaces that.
Great question. In fact, you're going to the end of the question, but we can't get there yet. Let's go. So this question he's asking is one that we have to keep in mind, right? That's what we're doing in the vein of systematic theology. We're trying to set our foundations in such a way that when we encounter this question, when Jesus says, right now, let's admit, when the guy walks next to him for a long time, or people are startled, and then someone's like, "I think it's the Lord," you're like, "How do you not recognize him?" But then he tells his boy, "Hey, tells Thomas, touch the holes in my hands, touch the." So he expects Thomas and those guys to recognize him. How does this all work? If we get the basic parts right, when we read that scripture, I think what we'll say is, yes, of course, I understand how this works. Whereas right now, because we don't have the basic parts at least all worked out and fitting together, we're like, how can this be? How is it the case that he had one body, but now he has a different body, and is he the same person? That's exactly the question we want to answer, but let's answer it foundationally forward. So hold that one, if you don't mind. And let me follow back up on something Randy said. Okay, so we're saying that it connects. I'm sorry, did you want to?
I was just going to say, I think the new body is the ghost that he drew.
Okay.
And I think that it was able to come out of and into our three-dimensional space.
Yes.
So yeah, that's all.
Well, let's go a little Harry Potter on this one. You know, the problem with the kind of the ghost part of it is, when Sir Nicholas goes and he walks through a wall, he also walks through a person. So Nicholas can't move stuff as a ghost. He cannot interact with the material world other than in some way where he can be seen. Or I can't remember. Ghosts can't do it. At any rate, the concept is that ghosts don't interact with the physical world in the same way that our bodies do. So how does that difference work? So Jesus did. So Sir Nicholas and Harry Potter can't eat anything. You know, they try at his death day party to try to taste something, but they can't even eat anything. They just pass through the table as they eat it. And I think he actually gives Ron a hard time at some point about mentioning eating, even though he knows he can't eat. So Harry Potter knowledge, very important to theology, especially systematic theology. The question is, how does it interact with a physical body? Let's say we simplify the question just to the point of, let's answer that one later, today, just this room, no further scriptural data, no further empirical data. You, in this room, where does your brain?
Every time you clip your toenails, you create a
workbook. There it is. It's even, because it's a terrible act to do so, and it splits your soul. Okay. Do you think that it's a region of the brain or the whole brain?
I think there's some connection that I'm not even going to try to explain.
Okay.
All right, fair enough.
Do you think it's a region of the brain or the whole brain?
No, I don't think it's a physical connection. I think there's some intersection between the spiritual dimension and the physical dimension that happens. Again, I don't even know if we can point to a spot.
I'm not going
to
pretend to understand it.
That intersection, does that intersection only occur in the physical space of inside your head, or does it occur in Al's coffee cup as well?
I don't know.
Okay.
Don't even have a theory.
So yes, sir.
God can be everywhere all at once.
All right, you're jumping ahead, so hold on to what you got. Answer the questions that we're talking here. Does your spirit tie to, interact with anything other than outside your head? Let's just draw it to your head for the simplicity. Let me give you an argument for why, maybe why. Yes, sir.
We're mentioning the brain, but I try to go with who you are, the identity.
Okay.
So I believe... I understand that what ties the spirit to my body is who I am.
Okay.
And if I go with my brain in a physical way, the only portion of the brain that tells who you are is the front lobe. So if I lose that front lobe with a stroke, do I lose my spirit?
Right. Good question. Or let's say that we're not going to even argue about the head. We'll just say that we'll posit that the spirit interacts with the head, or the mind interacts with the head. But he says identity. So is identity a whole body thing, Or is it just in your head? That is to say, if I cut off your hand, does that change your identity?
No.
Okay, if I cut off your forebrain, does it change your identity? You're saying maybe, right? Okay, so we don't. Let's say we don't have to answer that question. We're going to say that question's too hard to answer, and so we're going to say maybe it's the part of the brain, maybe it's the whole brain, maybe it's just, maybe it's a few parts of the brain, and other parts are superfluous to where this the soul interacts or the mind interacts with the brain. If there is, remember, we're pretending, we're already positing that that's the way that it is, but it's not your left shoulder. Or maybe another way of saying it is this: it's not the coffee cup. If who I am says, I want to grab that coffee cup, I want to move the coffee cup, I want to move it, I can't sit here and move it, okay? I have to send messages to my muscles, the muscles have to do things, then I have to push it. Okay, let's back it up from the coffee cup. If I want to wave my hand, I can't do that one from, I mean, I guess you could do that from right here, right? You could put the electrodes in the hand, but you're doing something there to make that happen. It seems to us, from what we know of empirical science, that the signal that says wave starts in the brain, or that's the first place we see it, is in the brain. It doesn't start here, right? Even when you get when you touch something hot, that there's not a subcortex somewhere that it goes and says, emergency, pull back. It's got to go all the way up your arm to your brain, and your brain's got to turn around and say, move it. That's the way that it seems to happen in our bodies, right? You're shaking your head.
There's a lot of people that don't get that.
But let's say that's the case. Yeah, let's pretend that we have established that that's the way that it is. All right, then what this should suggest to you is for us, for our spirits, minds, soul, whatever it is, the immaterial part of us, if there is an immaterial part, that the place that it interacts with this world is somewhere in the head or smaller. It's not beyond that. The idea that I would like to bring up that I think several people have pointed to now is God, in the same way that our spirit can change stuff in our brain. How does that happen in the brain? Is it an electric potential between two neurons that the soul actually makes change? I don't know, but let's say it's something like that. The fact that we can impose physical change on the brain causally from a non-physical thing, that's identical to the way that God does it. The difference is, you've only been given permission to interact with your brain. God, being the permission owner, can interact with any particle of matter, space, time, energy, whatever, that he desires. That's the difference and that's my view of omnipresence, is that's how it works. It works for God and the world, just like it works for you and your brain. That's what I think. I haven't justified it, I'm just telling you that's what I think.
Do you mean that he has the ability to, or that he is doing it?
He has the ability to. So, you know, if you MRI, fMRI your brain, it's not all lit up all the time. Okay. You can do it at different times. So,
go as far as to say God is interacting with my brain at this very
moment. Yeah, that's a good point. So, I did say identical. I was wrong to say that. What I meant to say is he does it in the same way. A difference, though, is that God also has the role of causally sustaining his own brain in that case. Whereas we don't have to do that. God's doing that for us already. Yes, sir.
Okay, my 1970s brain, right? So I'm sitting there one day.
This is because it was affected badly in the 1970s? Or because it...
take me back to like 1972 or 3.
Okay, all right, I got you.
I'm sitting there one day. I forgot where I might have been. I might have been in Monterey, Santa Cruz, or someplace. I might even been in Los Gatos, I don't know, it doesn't matter. But anyway, I'm sitting here, I'm thinking about, okay, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And that's what we're talking about right now.
Yes.
We are talking about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. We were created in their image. We all have that capability. Now, I'm not saying we're God, don't misunderstand that.
Right.
But, like you had just mentioned, you know, your very geeky statement about we don't have the permission set to think that high. But everyone is essentially a trilogy. Every human being is a trilogy unto himself.
So let's talk about this in Doctrine of the Trinity and in Doctrine of Man. But let's at least pause to note that when God says that we are made in his image, that means something particular. Because what we have said about God, we've said it several times in here, and we haven't got to this doctrinal point about it, but if God is... God is immaterial. That was one of the things I meant to cover later. God is an immaterial being. He isn't this anthropomorphic guy with the beard, right? The Sistine Chapel doesn't have it right. So that is a way for us to conceive of him, but that's not a correct way for us to conceive of him. So in that sense, or as we recognize that fact, what you say comes into particular play. In what way are we like God? What does it mean to be made in God's image? So this is these are biblical data that we want to interact with, especially when we get to doctrine of man. So let's hold on it till then, but absolutely, it needs to be mentioned. All right, let me make a short right turn because we're now into the question and answer stuff. This stuff, by the way, looks like we're good to continue it a little bit more next time. We'll talk a little more omnipresence next time, too. But we had a question, and this was from Minute Physics's, I forget, what was the...
religion and science and something. It's so off topic, though.
It is. It's definitely. Oh, here it is. Yeah, it's definitely off topic. The downside here is I can't give you the audio to this one. So. We're moving at the speed of smell with this connection. I apologize. Why is Chuck Norris on here? Do you see Chuck?
Okay. Kind of piqued my interest because, you know.
Can you put on subtitles? Yeah, if I know how to do it, if you can tell me how to do that, I will.
I'm bringing it up.
But it will only play here, so it would be hard to hear. I haven't jacked it into a speaker system anywhere. So it's trying to load. But it's called Science, Religion, and the Big Bang. So what I meant to write back to you ahead of time was, we'll answer this in class today. I thought this would load faster. So I would make a couple observations. One, this is done by a physicist. So it's not, you can't dismiss Minute Physics as that's some hack that doesn't know what he's talking about, just making videos. So it's a genuine physicist who's making these videos. That being said, the number of things that are depicted in this video that are inaccurate, that if you sat down even with that guy and said, is this right? He'd be like, no, yeah, I drew that wrong. Or alternately, yeah, if you just take the statement that way, it's wrong. The number of things that were wrong in this video, I just ran out of counting them. There were so many of them. It basically tries to make the case that there's a long-time view that the universe was static and eternal, and it could be eternal in the past, and we don't know. And this is Sir Fred Hoyle's view. This was called static universe view, and that Big Bang cosmology changed that. And so it complains about Big Bang terminology, which is fine. It wants to call it the everywhere stretch model. That's a better way of doing it. That's fine, too. But it turns around and says that Georges Lemaître came to the conclusion, one of the reasons that he was first to it, to the solution to Einstein's they don't say it this way, but he was one of the first people to solve Einstein's general relativistic equations for our universe, or for what we think our universe would look like, and that led to the conclusion that the universe started at a singularity and then expands outwards in what we call the Big Bang or everywhere stretch. And the reason he did that was because it's a particularly religious viewpoint, but it might not be right. Well, there's one problem there is there's another guy who wasn't looking at it from a religious view, to my knowledge at all, Friedman, who came up with it in Russia at about the same time that Lemaître does too. So saying this is a religious conclusion and that's why he went there is false. There's a lot of guys who are not religious in any sense that are overtly and stridently atheistic that believe in the everywhere stretch or Big Bang model. It's not because it was a religious model. So I object to the whole framing of this video because it makes it sound like Big Bang is a religious viewpoint. That's why people think that. But don't worry, science thinks something else, possibly. So it basically goes back to saying the universe could. This is not loading. I apologize. I don't know why.
You could literally draw what he did.
Yeah,
he showed a point in time. The thing that piqued my interest, I didn't really trust a lot of what he was saying, but he basically said that the singularity, yeah, just like that, the point in time. But how do we? One of the things that I was curious about was he drew basically time and space before the Big Bang. So basically everything sucked in again and then expanded outward again.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that.
So he's talking about bouncing units. So one, what he's not telling you is the model. This model that you see at the bottom is a model that is. You know, shows inflation happening very, very rapidly here, and then it changes the rate of inflation, and inflation expands again. So this is some of what we think goes on. This rounding off point, so this is the way people used to conceive of the Big Bang, that it starts and that this is the rate at which it's expanding in this direction is c, it's the speed of light, and that's how fast the universe expanded at speed of light. Well, then someone looked at this and said, it doesn't work if you do that. You end up with some problems we won't talk about, but a horizon problem and flat and a whole bunch of other ones. But you end up with some problems in there. And so what they said was, instead, maybe inflation happens in this early part of the universe, where we're talking like well below a second. So the universe, from some time when it's the size of less than an atom to when it was about the size of a grapefruit, that it blew up at over 1,000 times the speed of light. And that's what you have to do in order to make the Big Bang model work. So some people would say, well, that's a good reason right there not to believe in a Big Bang model, because it is apparently false. That's if you go all the way back to a mathematical singularity. Okay. Point two, singularities are an acknowledged problem. Anytime you got a singularity anywhere in mathematics, and they pop up all the time, everywhere, that is a problem for the mathematics. And many mathematicians and physicists will tell you that we're trying to work around these things. So even some techniques we use in modern physics today, one of them called renormalization, which is where you end up with these infinities at a point in space, and you basically do a mathematical process to cut off the infinity to make it finite and something you can deal with. There's a question as to whether that's a legitimate move. I don't think it's a legitimate move. I don't think infinities are actual. I think it's a concept and a poorly defined, by definition, a poorly defined concept. So Stephen Hawking came up with a model that basically kind of rounds off the universe like this, and that you can kind of quantum tunnel your way through to this rounded universe thing. And so it's no more legitimate to talk about what's before the universe than it is to talk of what's south of the South Pole. That this is rounded off like a sphere is, and so it's just a dumb question to ask. The problem is, to come up with that model, you have to use imaginary time. And when you take the imaginary time out of it, at the end of your equations, the singularity pops right back up in there. So the problem is this: Einstein's equations of general relativity require a singularity, the way that they're written. And so people are trying to find out, is there a way to write them or conceive of them or change them that doesn't end in a singularity? And he knew that. This wasn't a surprise to him at all. So going back to this guy's, I apologize, I won't do this to you next time. I'll answer it better by making sure we see it up here. Or if I can get it to run here, we'll answer this question in detail next time. But basically, the physicist then turns around and says, well, it's possible that you end up with a universe that was kind of like this, and it gets bottlenecked, and then it expands again. And so if you kind of draw the lines, kind of like you would on a globe, you know, like this, that it can expand back out again, and that maybe what happened in our universe was that ended up being terrible, but you get the point. That maybe it wasn't a singularity, maybe it just got really, really small. The problem with this expand, and so maybe the universe goes backwards in time all the way back here. The problem with this view is mathematically it doesn't work, because you end up with singularities on this collapse that never let you get back to the same state of very, very, very low entropy that you end up at the beginning of the universe. And so there is a theory out there that nobody, to my knowledge, has contradicted yet, but everybody whines about, is the Bohr-Guth-Palenkin theorem, that basically says as long as the rate of expansion of the universe on average is greater than zero, which is what everybody thinks, because here we are, as long as the expansion on average is greater than zero, then you have to end up in this singularity. You don't get to dodge it. The universe had a beginning. Okay, so one of the authors of that paper will quibble with that, with the implications of that conclusion, more than others will. But ultimately, this bouncing universe model has never worked, and everybody acknowledges there is no bouncing universe model that works.
It's period. Just percussion theory. That's all.
There's several. There's ekparotic universe. There's bounding universe. There's a whole bunch of stuff here. But the bottom line is, the math never works out for these things. So nice idea, but the evidence completely and totally contradicts it. So all that to say, even Stephen Hawking, who has many great reasons to want to do this, when you go to his webpage and you look at his lecture, where he's doing it to normal people like us, he says in there, literally this statement, quote, all of the universe from modern cosmology, all the data, from evidence from modern cosmology, suggests that the universe had a beginning approximately 13.7 billion years ago. He doesn't say some. He says all the evidence is that.
So when people come up with this normal, how do you measure time?
Yes, yeah, so time, the relative measures of time slow down compared to the density within some given space. You'll notice, and this is one of the objections that I have to how we apply the math. This, let me take a step aside because your question informs one of the questions that arises in this one. The guy says, the universe could be infinite for all we know. But even in a universe, he draws a sphere. Even in a universe that's of a certain size, there's still an infinite amount of space because the universe can expand into itself. All right, that is a very, very disingenuous statement, both from a physical perspective and from a mathematical perspective. The universe cannot infinitely expand into itself. What he's saying is, you can divide stuff up, draw the grid smaller and smaller, stretch that grid out, and then redraw the grid. He's ignoring the fact that you're redrawing grid in order to do so. That is a frame change, and you don't get to do that in mathematics or physics for free. That costs something, in my opinion. And to make it up is to take this straight from being math and physics that correlate to the real world to fairy tale. So I can go through it in greater detail for those that are interested. Maybe we could do a separate thing on it, going through and picking this thing apart. But at the end of the day, I'll forward this out. I'll post it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
The bottom line is this. You have to be very cautious in these popular level videos, because I will bet you, if I were a betting man, I would bet you a year's paycheck that I could sit down. I'm not a great physicist. I'm not even a physicist. Just a guy. I can sit down with the author of this video and say, get him to say at least 10 points, yes, that's not exactly accurate. Or alternately, yeah, I know the math doesn't work out. I just put it out there because it's an interesting thought. So if there are at least 10 of those points in a video that's 3 minutes long, caveat emptor, be careful what you accept on the outside, because even this guy wouldn't accept his own statements, is my point.
He does other good videos, though.
He does also. I love Minute Physics. In fact, I think I would love for Solid Ground to imitate that style very much. I love it. I'm just telling you, that one has an agenda, and he's acting like all the things that he says in there are either non-controversial or true, and that is absolutely not the case. So we can talk to math of it later, but there it is. All right. A little bit more on omnipresence, and then we'll also get into the next topic next time. But now you know some of the things to think about when it comes, not this physics stuff, but when it comes to, you can see some of the questions that we want to answer. And what we'll start out next time is we can get into the non-dualist views if you want to. But I would say let's punt that until Doctrine of Man time frame. But what we can talk about more next time, what I'd love for you to think about over this week is, how is it that you interact with your body? Does cutting off your toenail, does cutting off your hand, does cutting off your arm, is there anything outside your brain that matters? How does that spirit interact with the body? And then what is its implications for God? And just keep it in mind that if you take nothing else away from this one, remember that God isn't in heaven, sitting there on a throne, and he's not here. He is here as much as he is anywhere. Now, if he does a manifestation so you know it, like when he fills the temple with this Shekinah glory kind of thing, that doesn't mean that he's more in the temple than he is anywhere else. If he is omnipresent, he's here. He's right here. What is a personal application? Personal application is when you cry out to God, you don't have to wait for your words to get to him. You don't have to wonder whether he understands what's going on right there. And you don't have to wonder how long it's going to take him to get back to you. He wants to change it that instant, he can change it that instant. Just something to keep in mind. Carl.
Just to finish on that point, and it kind of goes back to Randy's question earlier, is there scripture that talks about his omnipresence outside of the Psalms? I'm sure there's some examples, but one example out of Jeremiah 23, beginning at verse 23, says, "Am I only a God nearby, declares the Lord, and not a God far away? Who can hide in secret places so that I cannot see them, declares the Lord? Do not I fill heaven and earth, declares the Lord."
Yeah, and see, again, prophetic language, so maybe there's metaphor going on here, but at the end of the day, look at the words that he's using here. I fill heaven and earth. Okay, now we're not exhausted by it. God's not exhausted by that filling. He transcends, probably. That's one way to think of it. But that's something else we got to think about, too.
He made a statement early on. He said, so is he a God who's hard and perfect and far away, or is he a God who's close and near us and has those feelings? And so the answer is yes.
Yeah, right. No, that's a good point. And that is maybe what we mean by transcendence at some point. Maybe another way to think of it that'll throw you a little bit of a loop. You don't have to worry about God thinking about you. If God is to this world as your mind is to your brain, you're in God's head. Always. He's always thinking about you. You are on the forefront of his mind. Every single person. And we'll talk about my systematic view of what the whole world looks like from a purpose perspective. But at the end of the day, I won't justify this one yet, but I'll tell you how far I think it goes. I think that God designed this world specifically to be best for you. You. But he's so smart, he overlaid all the worlds of best for Al and best for Carl and best for, you know, Lang, best for everybody. And he actualized the world that is the best for all. So now I'll talk about how that works out in the long run, but at the end of the day, you're never out of God. You never have to ask the question, Lord, how have you forgotten me? Like Christ, you can ask the question, why have you forsaken me? That's a different question. But that has a specific application in time that we don't have to worry about because he doesn't forsake us. Right? Okay. Thanks very much for your attention. Sorry this one wandered a little bit too, but this is an exciting topic for me, and I look forward to expanding on it a little bit next time, and let's have some more discussion next time too. Thank y'all, and y'all have a great week.